Okay. It's just so nice to sit in a cooler room that I'm just thinking of sitting here for 15 minutes because we managed to import White House humidity to the White House. It was very Washington, D.C. and room 31. So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a very short debrief. We're going to talk about what seemed to happen in the game, but not necessarily motivations or calculations of teams or what have you. We have three analytical teams, as you know, as you saw them nosing around, who are going to be interpreting what happened in the game. And we don't want to, in a sense, prejudge that by putting our own spin on things. As you know, in the design of the game was intended to explore issues of crisis stability in East and Southeast Asia in the context of growing Chinese sort of confidence in strategic power and uncertainties in U.S. policy, particularly in the context of a White House that in the scenario was very much focused on domestic political issues as well. So they're playing a two-level game of thinking about domestic politics as well as regional politics. Some of you may have worked out and some of you may not have worked out. This is a miniature version. Donald Trump was not a player. Donald Trump was a board game in which the U.S. team in the White House was trying to move various policy ideas forward or in some cases backwards in order to get the president to make statements that were the kind of chapeau, the kind of the overall framing of U.S. policy, which then U.S. diplomats liberally interpreted in ways that they thought were helpful on the ground. And the game mechanism there, I'm not going to talk too much about game design, but the game mechanism there was intended to recreate the political infighting which we see in this particular White House. I mean, it's characteristic of all administrations everywhere that there are different interest perspectives, political calculations, but I would argue as a political scientist that it's particularly acute in the Trump administration. What you saw in terms of U.S. policy may have appeared irrational at times, but there was a rationality to it. There were people in the room who cared about the president improving his position against the Republican challenger. There were people in the room who cared about the president making policy statements that would resonate with his Republican base. There were people in the room who viewed China as a threat. There were people in the room who didn't. There were people in the room who thought that a sort of resolute American military posture was important. There were people in the room that prioritized diplomacy. There were one or two people who wanted to make sure the Trump brand remained untarnished, and so on and so forth. So all of our players had incentives and were playing those incentives and were simultaneously, in a way, trying to do the best thing for the United States, but making sure that their particular worldview or constituency or policy priorities were reflected. There were very long, serious, intense policy discussions in the White House, but that infighting at times made it difficult for the U.S. to stay on message, or the message changed. And that, they said, that was an internal coherence. That was okay, that might not be too helpful regarding the Chinese right now, but it plays really well with the base, the issue of, you'll notice that at a time the U.S. was often trying to cooperate with China, there were rather hostile tweets coming across on trade because there were people in the White House who said, this is far more important, you need to get reelected, and you know, Chinese are a major threat on trade issues, they're a big problem, and that resonates well with the base. I want to praise the U.S. team for putting in enormous, enormous effort. We did have a White House chief of staff who was purged. We did have cases where we had massive amounts of innuendo, backstabbing, accusing other people of being conservatives and Republicans in name only and taking their influence cards away from them and so forth. And we did have a very skilled, as it turned out, Secretary of State who resigned just ahead of being fired at the very end, because having spent so much time trying to bring some coherence to U.S. foreign policy, they discovered they had absolutely no influence with the president whatsoever as a consequence of spending all their time focusing on foreign policy. So what we were trying to do is focus on, create that two-level game where U.S. policy was not just being driven by what you saw in the main room and the map room and so forth, but by domestic political calculations. How successful, we'll leave it for the analytical teams to conclude. But the tweets you saw were almost all repurposed Trump statements. They were either slightly reworded to fit another situation, or some of them, the MacArthur and the Kinley ones, were just the Pershing tweet he gave kind of repurposed to apply to China. So most of those things were things, they were in the universe of plausible Donald Trump statements. Whether they became U.S. policy was a function of the infighting and the policy negotiation in the White House. all I saw was the White House. I mean, I never got out of the damn White House. I can't talk about the broader crisis. I will say that the U.S. team had an interesting discussion right when the game ended, whether they made any difference in the North Korea crisis. So it'll be interesting to see whether others think they did, but they were certainly pleased with themselves.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
glad to hear that. So I was only involved in the rest of the world, so not so important. And I think that illustrates the other thing you were trying to get, which is to construct a bubble.
It was not an absolute bubble because people could go back and forth. U.S. diplomats were permanently in the map room more or less. The fleet commander was in the Pacific Command commander was in the room more or less all the time. So it wasn't a complete bubble. But if you were a policy advisor, in fact, even if you're a member of cabinet, it was quite dangerous to leave the White House because when you came back, stuff had been done behind your back because you weren't there. So it was a bit tricky leaving the place.
It's a kind of rule of political games is never leave the room.
Yeah. We had a card for that, too, that you could insert yourself in a room where you weren't supposed to be. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So the broader picture is harder, both easier and harder to describe. What I'd like to do very briefly, I asked the people who actually did the work today, the control team in the main room who were doing map and political control, who were circulating among most of you and facilitating that, I asked them to come up with a couple of bullet points about kind of key messages or key things to come up without analysing looking at a blow-by-blow account of events, because I think it was Wellington said that one might as well try to write a history of a ball as to write a history of a battle, and in this case, a history of a game like this is extremely hard to write, and we do have the records which will be subject to some...
30-year rule.
some cases, 30-year rule. So if I could just call on my, Rob, if you've got just a couple of words on...
A couple of words?
All right, a couple of words. Well, what time's dinner?
okay, so very quickly. I think there was a sense of bubble in every team, actually. Everyone was inwardly focused. Right at the very beginning, the sense of everyone trying to solve the same crisis, that quickly reverted to everyone dealing with their own internal problems and internal bubbles. There were multiple crises, and the fact there were multiple crises allowed bad news to slip under the radar quite a lot. Taiwan in particular got quite a lot of stuff done while people weren't paying attention to it. There was also a sense of increased purpose amongst the ASEAN members to try and cooperate against China towards the end. There was a feeling that they had to look after themselves against China. That came around as a
decision. This was absent USA, presumably.
Yes, yeah. Absent actually anybody else helping them out.
Right.
They had to help themselves. The other two things that came out for us is there was a palpable unwillingness to use military force, other than as a tool, occasional tool of coercion, which actually meant the massive US military capability had very little to say in the game itself. It would sail around and turn up, and people weren't coerced to sail away again. And was very little in terms of impact, I think, of the military forces. As a result, there was a much greater use of cyber capability, information operations, and intelligence operations, with a hugely varying degree of success and often failure. There was a much greater sense of the news feed being something that dominated thinking, and then people responding to that, rather than actually thinking about the bigger picture. So I think there was a sense in which military was not really a huge issue, but actually people just trying to coerce and intimidate, using news, using cyber, using influence operations, seemed to me to be more the order of the day. That's our broad observations.
Thank you, it's great. Certainly there was in attempting to get an overview, there was a sense of both, whilst North Korea appeared to be extremely threatening, there was a sense, as it was threatening, there seemed to be a sense, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out in the post-game discussions, there was also a sense that the main regional players were, or actors, were seeking regional solutions using regional resources, and as Rob alluded, America was actually less influential in this game. Stressing that in this game, each game is a unique event. It's not a simulation of what might happen. And in terms of our game design criteria, which we'll talk about later, that doesn't worry us too much. And as an aside, the other key thing about, as I'm sure most of you are aware in this sort of exercise, the composition of the player teams is a critical input to the process. And so player teams with a lot of experience enacted and followed patterns that drew on that. Players with maybe less, teams with less experience or less assertive or maybe with less subject matter knowledge perform differently. And so it's also important when looking at, well, they did this and then we did that, bear in mind that this is a very amorphous group of people with a wide range of different backgrounds and experiences. And so that's a major factor in terms of how things play out.
I will add two things. One is, I thought it was very interesting and in my view fairly realistic that the U.S. seeing North Korea as a major threat in the end came to the view that the status quo of an annoying North Korea might still be better than the options. So a North Korea that escalated to the point of conflict, a North Korea that collapsed internally, Chinese intervention, a whole system. When the U.S. team was grappling with what to do about North Korea, they were all unhappy with the North Korean situation, except for almost every other alternative looked worse than the one that they had. And I think that was a quite realistic portrayal of the challenge of dealing with the North Korea, that, you know, if you try to topple them, where could that go? If you get too provocative, what might they do, and so on and so forth. So unhappiness with the options and unable to find other options that got you safely to a better place. Another point, following what was said about sort of following the news feed, and I want to say this now in case I forget it, I want to thank the media team who came in from outside. So they're all out strange outside people. I want to thank them for two reasons. I want to thank them, first of all, for coming and being the media team. It's a hard role. You're extremely busy. You've got to stay accurate. You have the potential to wreck the game if you don't do the job well and don't, you know, report rumors or report inaccurately. They did a terrific job. There was just an enormous amount of well-reported news, which reflects their experience in mega gaming and other kinds of gaming. I want to thank them too because they're all volunteers Jim recruited Becky. I recruited a bunch of former students on Facebook. It took 28 minutes to find 7 people to come here all day. One of whom has come from Belgium and one of whom has come from Italy. So that's dedication, you know, to travel on Eurorail just to watch you guys all make fools of yourself for a day. But that was very, very important. It's important in terms of the way international diplomacy works and the information flow. Particularly at a time when information will often move in news streams and social media streams faster than it moves in bureaucratic streams. And in fact, my son just got hired got shifted jobs in the Canadian government to essentially monitor social media so that senior officials are in a position to know what's being said, because it may take another 2 hours before it's on the mainstream media, and it may take another day before it arrives through bureaucratic channels. So I think that this highlighted the extent to which that, as the news cycle gets shorter and shorter and shorter and faster and faster and faster, extent to which that sort of reduces the time for diplomatic consideration. So you may have seemed very compressed, and we were compressing a week into 30 minutes, but if North Korea hacks Donald Trump's Twitter account, it's not like you can spend a week deciding what to do, because everyone will know about it and there will be questions and people will talk about it on Twitter and it'll be live on the cable news shows like this. So the decision frame has really compressed from even the early 20th century. Yeah.
And I mean, I guess those are the kind of main things we have to say. I would say, I'm sure most of you saw the Twitter item which suggested that North Korean applause had more impact than Trump's tweets, and I have to say that was an interesting artifact of the game, which certainly distracted people in the main room when there were bursts of. I can only assume it is a testament to Brian's leadership as the leader of North Korea.
Well, I my important takeaway is that a ban on tube socks may be indicators of heightened North Korean alert, because I'd never actually associated tube socks.
So should we wind that up now and then people can have a bit of a break before dinner and hand over to Graham?
Okay, right. I'm going to continue the thanks in a second, but before I do that, just to re-emphasise what I said this morning about this was a